Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Many environmentalists and tribes have been united in recent years and months over proposed mining or pipeline projects they're concerned pose a hazard to our Minnesota waterways. But on the Standing Rock Reservation in south central North Dakota, a quiet, lonely place where the three biggest towns have under 1,000 people each, some kind of tipping point has been reached. On this reservation, in the middle of nowhere, where about 15,000 people live on just over 2 million acres of land, thousands of Native people and allies have gathered to shut down construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. More than an environmental protest, what does the action at Standing Rock have to say about the relationship of tribal people with the government, with their allies, and with each other? Let's meet our guests. Dave Thompson has been the news director at Prairie Public Radio in Bismarck since 1982, and I was honored to work with him years ago when I lived in Bismarck. Raina Crowe is a community organizer best known for her work with Idle No More here in Duluth, but she found herself an unintended guest on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, a program you hear here on KUMD's weekday mornings at 9 a.m. And Tad Johnson is an attorney, an enrolled member of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe Boys Fort Band, the director of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance Program here at UMD, and a former counsel and staff director in the Office of Indian Affairs and the Subcommittee on Native American Affairs, and he was appointed by former President Clinton to chair the National Indian Gaming Commission. Few people have their finger on the pulse of what's going on in North Dakota like Dave Thompson. So I asked him to give us a little history of the oil boom that's changed the face of the North Dakota I knew 30 years ago.
You build a pipeline, it's the safest way to get oil to market. And that goes back to the early days of the boom when a lot of oil was being put on rails, on rail cars. And they had those unfortunate explosions and some death. And as a matter of fact, there was an explosion outside of Castleton, if you remember that, Castleton, North Dakota, that if it would have been just a few more miles down the road, could have caused real problems in the Fargo-Moorhead metropolitan area. And that's over 135,000 people. And the tracks go right downtown. So there, the argument for a pipeline is, okay, we're going to have a place to put oil, transport it safely to where it has to go, where the refineries are. And, of course, you can argue about, some of the safety features that are built into pipelines. Pipeline companies will argue they've got shut-off valves and safety features and monitoring 24/7 because they're worried about the bad publicity. And because it is cyclical, it's boom and bust. And the fact is that the Bakken was only unlocked because of new technologies. There's a lot of oil still in the Bakken. So if the price goes back up, the rigs will be back. Now, the critical part of the situation is that there seems to be some evidence that, yes, there were surveys done about cultural artifacts and the sacred burial grounds. Yes, there were surveys, but they appear not to be very complete. And now that everything is stopped and there's going to be a review of what happened, I think that's very important because there are very serious issues that are involved with the siting of a pipeline. And even though this is the same corridor as the Northern Border Natural Gas Pipeline, there is a difference between natural gas and crude oil in terms of pipelines and what leaks happen and how leaks happen and what actually does happen if there's a leak. There are environmental issues as well. One part of Bismarck Mandan's objection to it was the fact that pipelines can leak, and they were worried about whether or not it might leak into the river. Now, let me give you a little context about this. We went through a very, I'm going to call it a big flood for the Missouri in 2012. When Garrison Dam was put in back in the 1950s, there was thought that that was going to protect Bismarck Mandan and downstream from floods. Well, 2012 was amazing because we had amazing amounts of rain, amazing amounts of water coming up from the Yellowstone. They actually open the floodgates at Garrison to bring flood water down. And that flood water changed the river. It changed the river that flows through Bismarck Mandan. Now people are, I think, understandably nervous about, what if this happens again? Will it expose pipelines? And you go back a year or two, remember there was a big spill in the Yellowstone River, you know, close to Glasgow, Montana, and that was basically brought on by floods that had happened that had kind of dug into the riverbed and finally did expose a pipeline. So there's a lot of worry there. So that was one of the reasons, but there were a whole myriad of reasons why not go that particular route. So they rerouted the pipeline to the area that is just north of Standing Rock. And there is, understandable concern and understandable worry based on what we went through back in 2012.
Raina Crow traveled to Standing Rock at the beginning of September by invitation, but her trip did not turn out exactly the way she might have foreseen.
Well, the reason that I went, and one of the things that I think is key in terms of what's different about what's happening now at Standing Rock, is that we were asked, citizens of this nation of the world, to come there by the tribal members on the ground, and a clear, explicit call was made. As I organize with Idle No More as a non-tribal member, I'm often bombarded with questions and concerns from other non-tribal members about, okay, we're starting to get it, what can we do to help? And in this particular case, the tribal members on the ground, one of my friends from Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is down there, Joy Braun. She's been fighting this thing for years. The people of Standing Rock issued a clear call and let us know exactly what they wanted us to do. By way of what I observed there, the camp is historic. It is something I think a lot of us, both tribal and non-tribal members alike, that at least try to understand issues involved with Indigenous sovereignty have waited for and hoped for many years. It's when you pull into the camp, as you approach, you see first all of the flags lining both sides of the road entering. And when you set foot on the ground there, you're kind of in time and space that just feels different. You know, the weight just kind of comes off of you. I observed people working together just naturally and seamlessly in a circle, doing all these things we always talk about that we should do as a community to make sure that everybody's needs get met, but it somehow doesn't happen. There's all kinds of arguments and hierarchy, and there's no discussion or argument out there. I didn't witness a single one. It's a group of people. There's food 24/7. There's water. There's warm clothes. Everybody has their needs met, and people do what they're able to do on the ground to make sure that the kids, the elders, everybody's cared for. But to have so much attention on the violent reaction that we encountered on September 3rd when we left the camp to go about a mile down the road for an observance, a commemoration of a massacre that had happened 153 years. We were not there for a protest. Nobody expected a protest. We went there to simply have a commemoration and an observance and turned around and noticed that the earth was being ripped up. So while that has overshadowed, understandably so, really what's going on out there is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's peaceful. It's beautiful. I overheard, I think the count is something like 7,000 people now. I hope Standing Rock stands forever in terms of the camp, the Sacred Stone and the Red Warrior camps. It's just beautiful. September 3rd was the, I believe, 153rd anniversary of a massacre very near that site, and the leaders of the camp. Something's planned every day, usually multiple things. There are lots of things to do, educational opportunities and observances. So on this particular day, we had headed very close to the what apparently turned out to be a dig site. We didn't know that at the time. And we're across the street, and there was a ceremony. There were elders that spoke. The descendant of a survivor of the massacre shared her story. And at one point in time, we turned around, and I don't know, things happened very fast. I don't know who first noticed it, but I looked around. A crowd of people were around after the observance was over, and I noticed that some were breaching the fence, and I looked up, and I could could just see the earth digging equipment. When I saw women, children, and a few elders go over that fence, I didn't think twice. I went across to find out what's going on. And immediately, there were workers there, and they seemed very shocked. And the workers actually began to get in their trucks and try to leave as people just kept coming onto the site. I followed the crowd over a ridge and was very shocked to see a line of, I thought at the time that they were workers for DAPL. It turned out I learned they were private security, but they had a line formed and they were holding various breeds of what appeared to be attack dogs. I didn't know they had pepper spray at the time. So some of us women, one of the women said, link arms, and I turned around, and she just looked like a good person to listen to. So us women, mostly, there were some men ahead of us, but a bunch of us women linked arms and formed a couple of lines and just started advancing. And we got very I didn't realize that as soon as we started moving, we were apparently being misted with some, I don't know if it was mace, pepper spray, or what, but it was some kind of a caustic agent. With my glasses and my bangs, I didn't feel it right away. And there was a young man that had gone ahead of us that was standing very close to me, and they were really spraying him hard in the face. It was, his face was beet red, and his, you know, white discharge was starting to come from his eyes, and I just impulsively butted in front of him, and then I got it full in the face. So this isn't like the dominant culture where everybody is each on their own. You know, people look out and take care of each other. So I reacted, too, to the dogs, and I was very upset about that. The handlers, if you want to call them that, did not appear to have any control over the dogs. The dogs were clearly confused. They were pulling at the, you know, every which way on their chains. And at one point, I observed a handler, quote-unquote, use his leash to pick his dog about 2 feet up off the ground. I tried, you know, I'm sitting here in the middle of this trying to get as much video and photos as I can. And I did get a photograph of him, unfortunately not fast, to, you know, to document that particular incident. I wouldn't leave the front line. None of us would until at some point the workers said, if you clear the bridge and let us get our trucks out, we'll leave. So when a bunch of us had gotten that statement on our videos or whatever, we decided to trust that. We cleared the bridge to enable their escape with their equipment. So the workers left, but the security people did not. A woman, I met her later and I can't remember her name. She's been on a lot of the video. She pulled me aside and said, you go back. You need to get medical care. You need to take care of your eyes. So at that point, I went back about 25 or 30 yards, and people were there with bottled water, and I was ordered to my knees to get my eyes rinsed out. I had realized that it was my hair was saturated, and as I began to sweat, it was then I was really burning. So they rinsed out my eyes. I pointed to the young man I was really worried about, and Candy, who's one of the IEN people, Indigenous Environmental Network, I said, he really needs help, and so she rushed over there. Things happened so fast, you know. It was such a blur. She came and just asked me what was going on, and again, I went out there to deliver supplies and make sure elders had their needs met. The very last thing I expected was to be involved in any kind of action, much less be talking to Amy Goodman. So that I was on my knees being taken care of on the site when Amy interviewed me. And then, like I said, I went back. One of the people grabbed me up and took me to their hotel room, and I washed my hair about 4 times to get all the stuff out, but it came out.
Amy Goodman was at Standing Rock September 3rd. In fact, Morton County, North Dakota, issued an arrest warrant for the journalist, accusing her of entering private property to conduct interviews. Here is a portion of her interview on Democracy Now! With Raina Crowe.
Let's go check on this woman. What happened?
I just a lot of mace, and the sweat was dripping it in. It was the sweat was making it run down into my eyes. I had my glasses on, and that spared me the brunt of it, but then the sweat started putting it in.
How are you doing?
I'm great.
What's your name?
Raina Crowe.
And what do you think you've accomplished today?
I hope we've accomplished letting Enbridge know that the people of this nation and the people of this world, tribal or otherwise, have withdrawn their social license to pollute water, and that they need to find an honest, nonviolent way to make a living.
Where are you from?
Duluth, Minnesota. I don't know more Duluth.
This is Tad Johnson. He's an attorney and the director of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governments program here at UMD.
It seems like a moment in history. This is a snapshot in history, and I think there's something really important going on right now. My education on that part of the country, I grew up here in Duluth, I'm a member of the Boys Ford Band, but I got out to Washington. I became staff director of the House Subcommittee on Native American Affairs, and we were on the committee dealing with natural resources, parks and public lands. I always seem to pair Indians with natural resources. So I said, I can't do water. I got a guy from Arizona who was a tribal attorney to do the water stuff. Somebody said, you have to understand North Dakota and the Missouri River if you want to hear a long case of injustice against Indian tribes. You know, we started off having treaties with Indian tribes. Treaty making ends in 1871. Supposedly the existing treaties were going to be good law. Then in 1887, it was, let's make the Indians farmers, so we'll create allotments there of 40, multiples of 40 acres. Well, what the General Allotment Act ended up being was a big land grant. Grabbed by the non-Indian population, and two-thirds of the land inside the reservation boundaries ended up in non-Indian hands. Then we get, there was a brief period of maybe we should treat the Indians like governments again during the Franklin Roosevelt administration. And then they went into the termination period during the late 40s, early 50s, where they actually, I mean, there was a policy called termination. We have better names for policies now today. We'd call this leave no Indian behind or something. If I can pull any positives out of this situation, first of all, I think the tranquility and the peacefulness prior to the incident that Raina was talking about. I had a tribal leader that I know real well, just got back from Standing Rock last week, and she said, you drive up and there were 134 tribal flags in front. And she said it was like nothing I've ever been to. And she said it was the most peaceful, tranquil camp she'd ever been to. And I have another friend who's an American Indian journalist who, I'm half Swede, so I kind of, I don't look like a real Indian. And he does. And he said he had his press pass on and after a while, he just took it off and he said, there's not too many groups where I can just fit in as a regular person. And then there were these unique legal events that all happened within about a half hour. It sounds like this court order came down where the tribes had lost on their position. However, then this very strange thing occurs where a joint statement gets released by the Department of Justice, the Department of the Interior, and the Army Corps of Engineers saying, okay, we're going to put a halt to this project. When President Obama, and he's probably been the best on this subject matter, he first met with the tribes in 2009, and he's met with them ever since, every year. And that'll happen pretty soon this year. And the first thing he asked was, what's the best way for me to consult with you? He required every department to create a consultation policy. Now, you get to see the effective ones and the not-so-effective ones, because I still advise a lot of mainly one tribe in Minnesota. And they were about to build Enbridge was going to build a pipeline across Minnesota. And the Army Corps had this kind of team of folks that will do the advising. And I was kind of being the reservation nice guy, and I called their Army Corps nice guy, who was a very nice fella. And so I wasn't able to be there for the meeting, but I set the meeting up, and they said, yes, it was all, they listened to us, sort of, and then they kind of were going to go ahead with their plans. Then lawsuits ensued, and then a lot of publicity and a lot of negative publicity, and it was kind of like, you know, what about the trust responsibility that flows from the United States to the tribes? And what about the protection of waterways? Because that pipeline was routed deliberately around two reservations so they wouldn't run into trouble. But as Dave was saying, there are sacred sites in spite of those, you know, no matter where the pipeline is going, that they didn't take into account. What they weren't expecting in Minnesota was some pushback from the tribes. The Mille Lacs Band can actually afford to do stuff like this. They had a guy who was a former high powered attorney with one of the federal agencies come out and conduct a real hearing where there were scientists and also American Indians. And they published their own hearing report, and everybody was lawyering up. And suddenly, now they've completely slowed down on that project. So that was kind of a dress rehearsal for what occurred out in North Dakota, which became huge and is now worldwide news. The court action did not go the way the tribe had hoped, but within 15 minutes, this you know, very unusual joint statement got released. And to me, it comes back to this concept you were talking about, which was tribal consultation. And that's a whole new dialogue that's going on between the United States and the tribes. And it's long overdue because when tribes, I was working for the House back when the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act had passed 2 years before I got there. And they were just starting to negotiate compacts between states and tribes. And this fellow from New York, Donald Trump, came in and testified. And the Mashantucket and Pequots were in competition with his casino in Atlantic City. He was saying that there's going to be organized crime. It's going to be the biggest scandal. One of the tribal leaders got up and said, "What? They're not really afraid of organized crime because Indian gaming has so many checks and balances on it. What they're afraid of is organized Indians." Overall, I think there's a ray of hope here in the end because suddenly it's kind of like the federal government is saying, maybe if we improve our consultation policies and try to further our understanding of this situation and these people and what they hold sacred and what's important to them, and hold seriously our trust responsibility to the Indian people, to federal land, and to the water. And when you talk to Indian people, it's all about the water. That was true here in Minnesota when they were going to go over 88 different rivers and water systems, including the Mississippi, which supplies the Twin Cities with a pipeline, and then out there, the Missouri River. I mean, it's all about the water. So if that kind of dialogue starts in earnest and the federal government starts taking its trust responsibility to the Indian tribes, to their water and resources, something good will come out of this. But I think people like Raina, and I'm going out next week, will walk away with this memory of, you know, this is what we can do together. And it's rather amazing.
I think everything at this point from the state government perspective is up in the air, and I think they're waiting for the kind of the court process to play itself out and also to see what the Army Corps of Engineers comes up with when they come down and do more surveying, do a little more in-depth look at things. There is a lot of, and I'll say it's palpable, you know, the back's up against the wall. Hey, you're impeding development. And then there are those people who are saying, wait a second, there's a point to be made here because it is a state-to-state, you know, relationship, and it should be. It should not be paternalistic. And the Native American people, the Standing Rock people, have a point because they are concerned about water quality. And we've had a number of oil spills on site. So oil spills are starting to get top of mind of a lot of people. So there is this dichotomy that there seems to be a lot of concern by state officials about the revenue being generated by the oil industry and how that's powering state government, and the recent drop in prices have caused a 90% budget here and some allotments by the governor cutting back on spending. So that's top of mind with them. And then there are people who are close to it. And I'm not saying that it's just the environmental community. There are ranchers, farmers, and city dwellers who are also saying, wait a second, we're concerned too. So there is a bit of a dichotomy. I think that's got to play itself out. The old saying is, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over. But really, there is a process, and I will give them credit for this process. When pipelines are going to be sited, and they've got a proposed corridor and proposed route, the thing called the State Historic Preservation Office, which is from the State Historical Society of North Dakota, goes out and surveys sites looking for artifacts, looking for sacred sites, looking for anything that might be disturbed. Now, at this point, there were a few sites found along the route of the pipeline, but there is some concern that it wasn't an in-depth look at things, and part of the reason for that was the earlier pipeline that was put through, and that was the Northern Border Natural Gas Pipeline. So the company and some of the regulators are relying on the surveys done from that time. But Northern Border is 25 to 30 years old. And in that time, there's been some progress and been some advancement in actually identifying and determining what the sites are. And there's another point in this, Lisa, I should bring to, because I hear this a lot, that, you know, the Public Service Commission said we had public hearings on these things. And if the Native Americans wanted to come, if the tribe Standing Rock wanted to come and complain and raise questions, they could have done so. They said they never came. Well, number one, they were not informed about it. Number two, there is truly supposed to be a government-to-government relationship here. The government should have reached out specifically to Standing Rock and said, here is the site that's proposed for this pipeline. Can you be collaborative? Can you come out and give us your opinions directly? Take us to the site. Show us some of these sites. That did not happen.
We have a government-to-government relationship with the federal government. That's the first thing. And we need to enhance that, make it better, improve the communication so that it's real and it's not lip service. And President Obama's vision, and this was the late Senator Inouye's vision, he chaired the Senate Indian Affairs Committee for years. He felt the trust responsibility flowed from every single agency, including the Army Corps. And they have to have an equally strong dialogue going with the tribes. Of all people, Jesse Ventura did the first government-to-government consultation policy by a Minnesota governor. And Governor Pawlenty kind of did the same thing as Ventura. And then Governor Dayton, to his credit, in 2013, redid the policy and enhanced it quite a bit to the point where he required state employees that were going to be working with Indian tribes and Indian people to actually get training on how to do that. So far, we've trained about 1,400 state employees. And there's a disconnect between the feds and the states, too. So there needs to be better dialogue among those three different sovereigns. And people have to remember there's 567 different governments, the Indian reservations, tribal communities, whether they're Alaska Native villages or they're Dakota communities in Minnesota, they are federally recognized Indian tribes, and there's different rules that apply there. And if there's policies being made by the state or the federal government, they've got to figure out some way to get along. And that's the same thing with county commissioners in Minnesota. And now the state agencies are getting a little better at it, but understanding that unique legal situation that has been going on for over 200 years between the tribes, the states, and the federal government is really hard to get through to elected officials. And we find ourselves educating a new crop of state legislators every couple of years and a new crop of folks in the federal government. And so it's a constant education process ongoing. And hopefully this government-to-government relationship that exists between the federal government needs to get better and between states. And the last frontier for tribes is always the county. The county government is usually the one that is closest to the tribes and understands the tribes the least.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. Thanks to our guests, Dave Thompson, news director at Prairie Public Radio in Bismarck since 1982, Raina Crow, a community organizer best known for her work with Idle No More here in Duluth, and Tad Johnson, an attorney and an enrolled member of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, Boys Fort Band, also the director of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance Program here at UMD. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.